Welcome to the Fed Life Podcast with Dan Seip from Serving Those Who Serve. In this podcast, Dan draws from years of financial experience to help federal employees overcome challenges that every Fed can relate to. Join us for this journey as we reach, teach, and serve to help you make the right financial decisions. Now, on to the show.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Fed Life Podcast. I am your host, Dan Seip. Additionally, I am the branch manager here at Lee Seip & Associates and Serving Those Who Serve. And as always, I want to say thank you for taking the time to listen to us, and above all, thank you for your service. You simply do not hear that enough. Well, let's see. Can anybody guess who my in-studio guest is today? I'll give you a hint. His initials are EZ. Yes, we are back once again with the guru, the incomparable Ed Zirndorfer, as part of our mission on an ongoing basis to reach, teach, and serve you. Now, at the outset, I have to say the opinions of our guest, Ed Zirndorfer, even though they are awesome, are not the opinions of Raymond James or Serving Those Who Serve. This podcast is presented for information only and not to be intended to be taken as advice. All listeners should consult their personal advisors before taking any action. So today, we have a two-part podcast, as we so often do. And we're going to be covering something that may have escaped your attention, or you may be watching it, called the SECURE Act. And it's a pretty major piece of legislation impacting retirement savings. And that's a big topic for our feds, so it's a big topic for us, so that's why we're going to be covering it. So this passed late last year in December, and it is the SECURE Act, S-E-C-U-R-E. And yes, that does stand for something. It stands for Setting Every Community Up for Retirement Enhancement. That's a mouthful, Ed.
I would say.
How did they come up with these?
I always wonder myself.
So I want to remind everybody, you know Ed. You read him in the Fed Zone. You Google his name, you get 8 pages of publications and also all of our podcasts. But in addition to being a wellspring of information about federal benefits, Ed is also an enrolled agent with the IRS. So that means he really knows his stuff when it comes to taxes. So that's why we're going to be digging in on this. And before we jump in, I want to remind you that this podcast will also mirror 2 of Ed's articles in the Fed Zone, which you can find at blog.stwserve.com or fed-zone.com. Yes, the guy's got his own now, so you can get to it there. So you don't have to worry if you're listening on the metro, trying to find a pen, or God forbid you're driving. Don't try and write anything down right now. It's all right there. Okay, so Ed, articles are awesome as usual, and you explain the bill as well as talk about the pluses and the minuses. So if it's okay, let's dive right in. You know, up first, the age limit for IRA contributions has been removed entirely. Previous, it was 70 and a half. I'm not there yet, but it will be someday. Why don't you walk us through that change?
Yes, Dan. One of the changes coming about as a result of the SECURE Act passage is the fact that an individual who has earned income or a spouse who has earned income, and that individual is over 70 and a half, is allowed to contribute to a traditional IRA. That was always the case with a Roth IRA. No matter, there was no age limitation for contributing to a Roth IRA, but there was an age limitation for contributing to a traditional IRA. Namely, when a person the year they turned 70 and a half, they were not allowed to contribute to a traditional IRA. Even if they were still working, even if their spouse was still working, was not allowed to contribute to a traditional IRA. With the passage of the SECURE Act, there is no longer an age limitation for contributing to a traditional IRA.
Now, that's a little bit scary to me because my youthful and brilliant partner Tom Lee has already re-upped me for another 10 years. And you know, I was kind of selling him on the idea that it would be 72. But if he thinks it can go on forever, I don't think he's going to let me leave. What advantages do you see from your side where that change is concerned?
The big advantage, Dan, is the fact that that the other type of IRA, Roth IRA, which I mentioned, has no age limitation. The only limitation with the for contributing to a Roth IRA is income. If a person's income is too large, they're not allowed to contribute to a Roth IRA. Mm-hmm. With the removal of the age limitation for a traditional IRA, an individual would be eligible to contribute always to a non-deductible traditional IRA, meaning that their contribution would not be deductible in their taxes.
Gotcha.
However, what they could do is put the money into the non-deductible traditional IRA and then immediately turn around and convert it to a Roth IRA.
Okay.
And then if they do it right away, because they already pay tax on the contributions, they wouldn't have to pay tax when they convert that non-deductible traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, because the contributions were already taxed. That's called a so-called backdoor Roth IRA.
Right. You had covered that in one of our earlier podcasts, so that would be an advantage. What disadvantages do you see?
The only disadvantage I see, Dan, is the fact that contributing to a traditional IRA, it means a little more paperwork. It also means that if you're going to do the backdoor Roth IRA, please get professional tax help in doing
Absolutely.
It. One should not do that on their own. It can be very complicated, and if you do the wrong thing, the consequences can be severe as far as IRS is concerned.
And Ed is not going to answer emails on that. Just letting you know that. He's super helpful. He always tries to help people. If you send him, hey, how do I do a backdoor Roth? You're going to get a polite response.
Thank you, Dan. And also I want to point out that as we're going to talk further, that traditional IRAs, unlike the Roth IRAs, are subject to what's called required minimum distribution. They have increased the age. We'll talk about that here in a few moments. But putting more money into a traditional IRA means that if you're not going to convert it to a Roth IRA, that those contributions and earnings on those contributions will be subject to what's called required minimum distributions starting the year that one becomes age 72. Actually 70 and a half if you were born before July 1st, 1949. We'll talk more about that here in a few moments.
Well, gotcha. That's a great segue, but I will also stress, for some of these tax ideas, again, we're not giving advice here. Consult somebody who is really, really, really experienced with this. Get good advisory help, get good tax help. So, great segue, Ed. Moving on, there's a big change in required minimum distribution rules. Under the previous rules, the same age of 70 and a half that we had as a cap for making IRA contributions was the date that the folks had to start taking withdrawals from traditional IRAs, TSPs, 401ks, etc. Tell us how that has changed.
Effective January 1st, 2020, for anybody who was born after June 30th, 1949, the so-called required beginning date, RBD, is now age 72, not 70 and a half. The law says now that if you were born after June 30th, 1949, you must start withdrawing your traditional TSP, Roth TSP, 401ks, traditional IRAs. The first required minimum distribution is due no later than April 1st following the year that you turn age 72. That's the first one. And every year thereafter, the deadline is December 31st for that year's RMD.
Now, assuming that also means if somebody does push it over to April, they're going to have to take two that year, correct?
That is correct. So let's do an example, Dan. I am turning 72 in the year in 2023. January 2023, I'm turning 72.
You look great.
Thank you. So my required my first RMD for my TSP account, I don't have any traditional IRAs, but I'm retired from federal service, so I must take out RMD for my TSP would be due no later than April 1st, 2024. If I decide to take out that first required minimum distribution in January, February, or March of 2024, I still have to take out another required minimum distribution for the year 2024 that's due no later than December 31st, 2024.
Gotcha. Okay. And, you know, we see from time to time, sometimes the reasonable folks will push from 1 year to the next is maybe they have more taxable income in the year that they turn 7.5, and the following year they may not have it. So again, it's up to the individual. So that's more time for growth, and that's good. What else do you see as advantages there?
Well, the fact is that they don't have to worry about taking the money out for another, let's say, year and a half. I'll be honest with you, this 70 and a half can be very complicated. You know, some, you know, people, the year I turned 70 and a half, well, why can't it just be age 70? That's the way they wrote the law. Now it's a plain 72. It's a lot easier to understand when you turn 72 as opposed to 72 and a half, where you got to go ahead, project ahead 6 months.
Sure.
So that's an advantage. As you mentioned, there's more time for tax deferred growth. But also it allows for more growth, not only in the traditional IRAs, but also for your TSP account, 401k plans, things like that. So that is a big advantage there.
Sure. Do you see any disadvantages?
The disadvantage is perhaps the fact that people may get a little more lax. They think, oh, I got time, and then time goes on, and they forget about it, and they turn 72 and forgot, and they really got to take their first RMD. They're so programmed to the 70 and a half.
Right.
Also, I want to emphasize again, the increase of 70 and a half, of the RMD age from 70 and a half to 72 only applies to people who were born after June 30th, 1949. If you were born before July 1st, 1949, you are still subject to the RMD age of 70 and a half, the first RMD. This gets a little confusing. Some people think it applies to everybody. No, it does not. They only raise it for people born after a certain date.
Gotcha.
Okay. This can make things a little more confusing.
that keeps tax experts employed. Okay, up next is one folks might not even think about. It was interesting to me, and of course, if it's obscure and interesting, nobody else knows it. Ed does. So taxable, non-tuition, and stipend payments being treated as compensation for IRA contribution purposes. Walk us through what type of person would receive that, and it sounds like an advantage, obviously.
You know, Dan, I've had over the years many clients who have sons and daughters who do they do these fellowships at NIH or downtown agency, Woodrow Wilson Foundation, something like that. And they get these 1099s showing their stipend payments like that, and they say, you mean our son or daughter has to pay tax on that? Yeah, it's included as income. Is there any way that can be offset? I said, they can't. The non-tuition stipend payments are not considered to be compensation for IRA purposes. Ooh. In order to contribute to an IRA, you or a spouse has to have so-called earned income, wages, salary, or self-employment income, net self-employment income. The stipend payments are not considered until now as compensation for IRA contribution purposes. Now they are. So there are two things coming out of this, I feel, that this change. Number one is it allows somebody who's young, who has no other income, to start saving for retirement right away, which they should. And two, it'll say if they put the money into a traditional deductible IRA, they can save on taxes.
Great.
Okay, so they're saving now, and they're going to save for the future.
That seems like a good fix, because they were getting taxed on the money, so Uncle Sam considered it income to them. So that seems like that's, I realize that's not going to affect a whole lot of people, but if it's one of your children, you're going to be happy you listen to this podcast. Now, the last one for today that we're going to talk about involves the exception to the 10% early withdrawal penalty. Folks, I think everybody's got this burned into their head that if you're in a if you're in any type of traditional IRA, 401k, things like that, and you want to take money out before you turn 59 and a half, you're going to pay taxes and you're going to get popped with a 10% penalty. So I think everybody is kind of in this day and age aware of that. Well, it looks like in this they're giving a nice exception to that with being able to make a withdrawal before 59 and a half for childbirth or adoption, which I think everybody's in favor of families and things like that. Why don't you walk us through that change?
Okay, so young parents will have now additional money. They can take up to $5,000 to pay for any expenses related to birth or adoption. Okay, it also applies to any subsequent. They have a child, let's say this year, and then they have another child in, let's say, 2 or 3 years. They can use that money to pay for the cost of a childbirth or the cost of an adoption. Mm-hmm. Now, this $5,000 is per parent. So, frankly, a couple could take out $10,000, okay, in a given year to pay for any childbirth or adoption expenses, okay? Mm-hmm. But also, the parent or parents is able to repay that amount, okay? They can put the money back into the qualified return plan, such as the TSP and IRA, from which the distribution was made. Normally, when you take out a loan, you pay it back. But if you take a distribution, I'll give you an example. Individuals take up to $10,000 out of their IRA to pay for their first home.
Sure.
You know, pay for things like a down payment or closing costs. That money's not going to be repaid. It's just out. And you got to pay tax, right, with no penalty if you're under 59 and a half. But the money is there, but you're not going to repay it. With the exception to the childbirth and adoption, mm-hmm, there's no 10% penalty, and you can pay it back with no restriction. Okay, you don't have to, but if you do, you can just repay your retirement account.
Okay, now mechanical question. So if you have husband and wife married filing jointly, would the five have to come out of their respective pre-tax accounts? Or could the 10 come out of one and they both claim?
They have to come out of their respective accounts.
Okay, individual ones. Okay. And so on the surface, you know, having access to the money, being able to pay it back, sounds like a pretty good thing. But I can always tell by Ed's brow when it furrows on these topics, when there's something that he wants to caution people about. So on the surface, that sounds good. But I know from reading your article, you have some concerns, and why don't you share those?
Yes, Dan. I'm not a big fan of using one's retirement account to fund your current everyday expenses, whether it's buying a house or to have a child. And I want to cite the following example, why I feel that way. Mm-hmm. Let's take a federal employee who's 26 years old and takes $5,000 out of his or her TSP account after, let's say, having a child or adopting a child. They're going to use those expenses to reimburse themselves. The employee is now 26 years old and has no intention of paying back the $5,000. And let's suppose that $5,000 coming out of TSP was actually invested in a TSP C fund.
Oh, yeah.
Which, according to Morningstar ratings, has an annualized portfolio average annualized return of about 10%. So over 60 years, by the time that employee becomes 67, the $5,000 withdrawn would have lost, 40 years worth of earnings?
Yep.
At an average return of 18%. If that $5,000 had stayed in the TSP account, the $5,000 would have grown to $226,300, according to my calculation.
Double. Of course, at 10%, it doubles every 7.2 years.
Past return is no guarantee of future performance. We know.
Thank
that.
You for okay. saying that. Okay. I could hear my compliance department okay. shaking the door.
But if two parents are each drawing $5,000 in their respective accounts, let's say they're both federal employees, the $10,000 would have grown to $452,000. That is a lot of money for retirement. With more children and subsequent $5,000 childbirth adoption expenses, a married couple could stand to lose, let's say, close to $1 million in potential income for the retirement. In short, the $5,000 is in many ways similar to a TSP loan in that it should be used as a last resort. Even if it's paid back, the lost earnings on the amount distributed in most cases cannot be made up, or they're lost forever. Okay. And by the way, if the distribution is paid back, taxes will have to be paid twice on the amounts distributed. The first time when the money is taken out of the traditional TSP, let's say, mm-hmm, and the second time the amounts paid back are used with after-tax dollars. It's not pre-tax.
So you're paying twice.
You're paying tax twice on the same money. Okay. So again, I'm not a big fan of this. I think if one's going to have a child, God willing, have a child, adopt a child, money should be set aside separately to do this.
I think that's very good advice, and I can tell you something. If you really want to see Ed's brow furrow seriously, bring up the idea of paying taxes on money twice. He really doesn't.
Bad not paying it once.
He doesn't. He's not a big fan of that. Okay, well, Ed, you've done it again. You know, this is a chewy topic. As a matter of fact, Ed teaches classes on this, and he gave everyone in our firm a quiz. And if we didn't pass, we have a 3.5-hour class that we sit in with Ed. So far, we're 2 for 2. Our first two guys who have turned them in, one of which is me, we managed to pass. And you know, I think one of Ed's greatest gifts is that he can take these challenging topics and make them accessible. So keep in mind, if you come to our seminars, things like that, you know, this stuff ultimately makes its way into everything that Ed teaches. You've done it again. You give him a good framework for making some good decisions. And folks, that's a wrap. Now, Ed will be back. You are coming back, right, for part two?
Of course.
Because I got a good grade on the quiz, but I am not ready to take that on by myself. So you'll be coming back for part two as part of him helping us reach, teach, and serve you. We are Serving Those Who Serve. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on our YouTube channel and coming soon to Spotify. And remember to share it with your friends and strangers, even some enemies. Be nice to your enemies. Share the podcast. Seriously, Ed, we have regular listeners now. So if your friends want to hear Ed, you know, share the link, and we will keep coming back to help more feds each day, right, Ed?
Absolutely. Thank you, Dan.
So check us out on Twitter and LinkedIn. Don't forget our seminars every month around the DMV featuring the guru, Ed Zerndorfer. We also have a special edition coming up where we are going to do one on taxes and TSP. So email us, tell your friends about it. We'll be getting that out soon, but that's going to be a special one day, Ed, on two of his favorite topics, TSP basics and strategies, and taxation. Ed Live is an experience you do not want to miss. So for more information, go to stwserve.com, click seminars and events. Be sure to read Ed every week now in the Fed Zone at blog.stwserve and also fed-zone.com. So for Ed, the crew at Serving Those Who Serve, and me, Dan Sipe, good luck. Godspeed, and above all, remember, it's your Fed life. Please, please, please make it a great one because you deserve it. We are out.
Thank you for listening to the Fed Life Podcast. Click the subscribe button below to be notified when new episodes become available. The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the guest and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Serving Those Who Serve or Raymond James. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional investing advice. Always seek the advice of your financial advisor or other qualified financial service provider with any questions you may have regarding your investment planning. Securities offered through Raymond James Financial Services Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC. Investment advisory services offered through Raymond James Financial Services Advisors Incorporated. Serving Those Who Serve is not a registered broker dealer and is independent of Raymond James Financial Services.
Raymond James is not affiliated and does not endorse the opinions or services of any of the quoted professionals or their respective firms. Any opinions are those of Dan Sipe and not necessarily those of RJFS or Raymond James. This case study is for illustrative purposes only. Individual cases will vary.
Neither Raymond James Financial Services nor any Raymond James financial advisor renders advice on tax issues. These matters should be discussed with the appropriate professional. Investing involves risk, and you may incur a profit or loss regardless of strategy selected, including diversification and asset allocation.
Raymond James is not affiliated with and does not endorse the opinions or services of the quoted professionals or their respective organizations.